That was Habib Kote. And my name is Emily. You've been listening to Chicks Voices on KHEN LP 106.9 Salida. Up next, we have Truth Quest with Melody. Thank you so much for joining me this evening, and we will play some more music for you next week. And have a good one. Stay warm.
Poker Face, I'd Rather Die. And you're listening to KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, and this is community-supported radio. We're streamed on the internet at khen.org, and if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest, we're now available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And I'm Melody, and my co-host this evening is Shannon Hemingway. And our guests tonight, we have two. It's Janet Phelan, and I've had her on previously. She's a great research journalist. And then I've also got Susan Lindauer, who's a whistleblower, and who's been kind of caught up with the Bush administration on some information that has to do with the pre-war with Iraq. And Susan and Janet, are you there?
I'm right here. This is Susan Lindauer. It's so nice to be on your show tonight.
Great. And Janet, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Melody.
Hi,
nice
Janet.
To be on your show.
Okay. I'll go ahead and let Susan start out, but let me first do a couple of things here, and one of them is the views expressed on this program are those of myself and are my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And support for KHEN and Truth Quest is brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Property Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access. Just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at coloradohomeproperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. Susan, I know you can do a much better job than I can at trying to explain a little bit more of your background for my audience and then the predicament that you're now in.
It certainly is a complicated story, I'll tell you. And it's a scary story. So when people first hear this, they really find it hard to believe that such a thing could have happened. And unfortunately, it's all true. I was what's called an asset. And an asset is somebody who's used by the intelligence community to establish very difficult contacts that they use private expertise or special, for example, I was involved in the anti-sanctions movement, and I was an anti-war activist all the way from day one. And so the American government came to me and they said, hey, back in 1996, they said, hey, why don't you establish contact with the Iraqi embassy, and you can use your anti-sanctions work and your anti-war work to try to persuade them to work, to help to support anti-terrorism policy. So that is how, very briefly, how I got to be involved in anti-terrorism work involving Iraq. And we opened up a back channel for anti-terrorism information. And that made me, jumping ahead 7 years at the time of the war after 9/11, that made me a big threat to the Bush administration, because they wanted to say that Iraq was not doing certain things and that Iraq was not cooperating. And in fact, a lot of the things that Bush told everybody was a lie.
Okay, now when did this start out that you became an asset?
I first became an asset in, the United States government came to me in 93 and 94.
Okay.
And so my work in anti-terrorism went back about 9 years before the invasion of Iraq. So I was very well established. And that meant that I knew all kinds of things that they didn't want to tell anybody. And so I ended up getting, Melody, I ended up getting arrested on the ridiculously bogus charge of acting as an Iraqi agent, which is different than espionage. I want to be very clear. I've never been accused of espionage. That would be something entirely different. They accused me of being that, they said that because I was an anti-war activist, that my anti-war activist meant that I was an Iraqi agent.
But they're the ones that had gotten you to get involved in this.
Exactly. They, yeah, and that was my defense was, I said, well, wait a minute, you know, I was doing this for you, and the United States government was supervising all of my contacts. The United States government was debriefing me constantly and giving me instructions constantly. So how could I be guilty if I was obeying the United States government? And that caused some consternation.
Well, I think Shannon has a couple of questions here for you while we're at it.
Susan, I think your story is very interesting. You keep saying the U.S. government. So who exactly came to you?
Excuse me, could you talk a little louder, please?
I'm wondering who exactly from the U.S. government, who represented themselves as the U.S. government, came to you?
Very good question. These were two very well-established individuals. One of them was named Dr. Richard Fuse, who was a top-level CIA guy. His history is fascinating. He was involved in the hostage rescue of Terry Anderson from Beirut in the 1980s. He had investigated Lockerbie, the bombing of Pan Am 103, from the very beginning, and he claimed to know who had done Lockerbie. He was also had done some brilliant, cloak and dagger kind of espionage stuff in Syria. He had stolen the blueprints for Syria's brand new telecommunication system, and they were Syrian intelligence tried to kidnap him in London, and it involved like a big Scotland Yard sting, and he really did the James Bond kind of stuff. So he was somebody who was very well established and highly positioned and extremely knowledgeable about terrorism. He knows people who are the real thing.
And where was he from, or who was he connected with?
He's from McLean, Virginia, which is the hometown of the CIA.
Okay. I mean, because when I looked at the spelling of his name, is he of Middle East descent, or am I? I mean, because it looked a little bit.
It's actually Hungarian.
Hungarian, okay.
Yeah, but he was born in America. Distant relatives, 50 years ago or 100 years ago came here, but his great grandparents may have come across, but he was born here.
And Susan, this is someone who you still trust.
Oh, do I still trust him? That's a very good question.
I mean, do we associate him with people who accuse you, and I put this in quotes, as being incompetent to stand trial, unquote?
It was extraordinary. My bona fides in anti-terrorism are quite outstanding. I was arrested for the sake of your audience. Just let me tell you, I was arrested 5 years ago, and in 5 years I was allowed, finally, after 4 years, I was allowed exactly one hearing, one pretrial hearing. And at that hearing, on one morning in New York City, and never again, they would never let me go back into court again, we had a witness testify that I warned him about 9/11. And his name was Dr. Park Godfrey, and he's a professor at York University in Toronto, which is the third largest university in Toronto. He's a professor of computer science, a meticulous, precise speaker. He was not, he's very methodical and highly reliable and credible. He would not overstate anything by even one word. And he said, she's been telling the truth. I warned about 9/11. And I told him, he remembers that in the summer of 2001, I was telling him that we expected a major terrorist attack involving airplane hijackings, and that the most likely scenario would be a reprise of the first World Trade Center attack. So I had told him that there would be airplane hijackings and the World Trade Center, and he remembers that in August of 2001, I told him that an attack was imminent and that he should not go into New York City, because if he went into New York City, he might get killed there. So this was the only time I was allowed to have a hearing. And as soon as they heard that, they said, no more hearings for you.
Well, how did you get this information, and for
whom?
Well,
I had been involved in with Richard Fuse, and Richard Fuse, we had been doing anti-terrorism work involving several Middle Eastern countries, Libya, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Hezbollah, and Egypt. And Richard had been telling me for several months that he was concerned about it, and that he was pushing me very hard to ask Iraq and Libya, to demand, not to ask, but to command and threaten Iraq and Libya, that if they knew anything about airplane hijackings, that they had to come forth and tell us immediately, because if there was an attack, and we found out that they had not told us about it, that we were going to bomb them back to the Stone Age in ways they'd never felt pain before. And so Richard had been extremely agitated about this for months. And, it's an interesting twist that unfortunately, we turned out to be right.
I mean, because apparently it sounds like there was quite a few people that were given this information or had run across it, because and apparently there were a lot of people that worked within the system that seemed to kind of ignore it, or those that weren't ignoring it were silenced, one or the other.
Well, certainly there was British intelligence and whatever. What would you have to say about those who were supposedly giving the U.S. the same intelligence you were? Were they outside of your system or pretty much within the same group of intelligence people?
Well, I will tell you that Richard's sources, at the time of 9/11, on the morning it happened, Richard and I were in contact with each other before the buildings even fell. And so as soon as I saw the airplanes hit the World Trade Center or heard about it, I called him and I said, you know, what are we going to do? You know, what do you want me to do? You know, because we have all, this is what we do. We do anti-terrorism work. So Richard said, Susan, and he said, I remember it was a very serious, thoughtful response. He said, do you realize that somebody is standing on the sidewalk with a video camera waiting for those airplanes? Do you realize that they knew it was coming? And I said, and I let off some expletives, and I said, those dirty sins of blah, 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 blah. I can't say it on the radio. And I said, you're telling me they knew. They knew this was going to happen, and they didn't tell us. And he said, well, maybe they did tell us. And then the phone went dead, and I was like, ooh, and Richard and I were cut off from one another. And so then I talked to him again, and he said that it was Israeli intelligence that had known, and that it was the Mossad agents who were standing on the street corner waiting for the airplane.
Did you feel a little duped, or that maybe your information was going to be misused to represent it as a true terrorist attack as opposed to an inside job?
Well, what has happened is that the Bush administration, and I realize there's that, you know, you've got a, you know, Colorado is kind of a red-blue state. I know everybody voted for Obama this time around out there, but I know that, you know, my family's from Arizona, so I know Colorado more as a conservative kind of state, if I'm not offending any of the liberals out there. And it may upset some of the conservatives and the Republicans to realize that Republican politicians have been playing a lot of games with 9/11. They've been using it as a soundbite I'm furious about it. They've been using Iraqi pre-war intelligence and 9/11 as a soundbite, as a press conference, and they've been playing really fast and free with the facts. And what they've said is not necessarily true, and it was not handled well. And I think that for example, especially with regards to Iraq, they lied through their teeth about it. For example, it is a fact that the Iraqis offered three things that we needed. If you were serious about terrorism, there are three things that the Iraqis offered that were just extremely valuable. One, the Iraqis offered to give us financial and banking records on Al-Qaeda figures. Okay, now if you're serious about terrorism, shutting down the financial pipeline for Al-Qaeda would be your highest priority. George Bush and the Republican Party in Congress did not do that. They had an opportunity. They manipulated 9/11 and told everybody how they were so devoted to it. But then when the opportunity was presented to them to do something real, they missed it. They refused to take it because they didn't want to take any help from Saddam. So we lost this opportunity. Well, who do you think is going to have the financial records on Al-Qaeda? Saddam is going to have them. Nobody else is going to have them except the bad guys. So if you don't like Saddam, then you've got to get Saddam's help, because Saddam is going to have things that you can't touch. Okay? The other thing that they had was evidence of Middle Eastern participation in the Oklahoma City bombing. And again, the great George Bush, the great Republicans in Congress, refused to take that information. The third thing was that the Iraqis invited the FBI to come into Baghdad and to set up a task force with authorization to make arrests and to conduct investigations and interview witnesses on terrorist attacks, on terrorism. It would have been profoundly valuable. One of the guys that they were going to give us was a young man named Zarqawi. Zarqawi was actually in Baghdad at the same time I was, and the Iraqis were like, oh my God, this guy is so terrible. He is so awful that there's some men who belong in Guantanamo Bay, and you guys should come and arrest him and take him to Guantanamo right now. And for the Arabs to say that about anybody should tell you how really awful he was. Well, he went on to kill hundreds of American soldiers, thousands of Iraqis, blowing up hundreds of buildings. The man is, you know, he's now been killed, but the cost of getting him turned out to be horrific.
In human lives.
In human life and destruction of property.
And yet he was offered.
So, I mean, we you know, the Republicans have been, you know, it's not really the cover-up of 9/11 before it happened, because, to be honest with you, I could not have stopped it. Richard could not have stopped it. Even though we knew something was coming, we couldn't get our hands on specifically what it was to do enough. It was like we were all waiting. It's like one of those horrible situations where you're waiting and you know something's going to happen and you can't do a damn thing about it. And it kills you not to be able to do it. But what makes us all so angry is that after 9/11, there were all kinds of opportunities that were totally wasted. And the wasting of those opportunities, you know, means that the financial pipeline for Al-Qaeda is still intact. That money has probably been used in Mumbai, in the attacks in Mumbai, the attacks in Indonesia, the attacks in Spain. All this money has continued to circulate for years. And all the opportunities to shut down the bank accounts have been lost. You know, the next time there's a terrorist attack on the United States, it'll be because of this.
And that money comes from what?
Well, that comes from, you know, the some legit. I'm sure that some of the investments are legitimate. It could be, you know, Saudi oil money. It's
Susan, can I ask you? There are some people who do not separate Saudi oil money from CIA funneled money. Is that an inaccurate correlation?
Would you repeat that again? You just said something important.
Is it fair to interpret Saudi oil money as being independent in any way from CIA funneled money?
I will tell you that Richard Fuse made his fortune, and he is so, pardon me, damn wealthy, worth $100 million from the Saudis. The CIA and the Saudis are so inextricably linked that they provide wealth to each other. They like Richard Fuse gave protection to the Saudis, so the Saudis paid him a king's ransom for it. And so you have, I mean, they have bought and paid for services from the United States government to the point that they have bought employees from the United States government. Does that make sense?
Right, but are you also connecting the fact that then the CIA would be connected with Al-Qaeda? I mean, as being, and maybe that might be one reason why they didn't want to, you know, deal with them.
It's a very interesting question, isn't it?
Are you being coy? I mean, because what in your interpretation, Al-Qaeda translates as the database, or is that inaccurate?
I'm sorry,
the database of people funded by CIA originally to fight in Afghanistan.
Yes, that is part of where it comes from, but it also, you have, it's like Osama bin Laden is a bazillionaire. His family is worth billions and billions of dollars. And the Saudi king would distribute projects, like, you know, on a quota basis. And he'd say, okay, the first project is for you, like building the dam is going to be worth $3 billion. And now we're going to give that to this family. Then we're going to have a bridge, and we're going to give it to that family. We're going to pay them $3 billion. So the Saudi king was distributing the oil wealth of the realm, you know, on a percentage basis of big projects throughout these families of the kingdom. And so that's how they made their money. And so the Saudi king bought the families, and then the families have been, you know, supporters of jihad, like Osama bin Laden. So it's like it is highly incestuous, though, between the CIA and the Saudis, and the Saudis and the Bushes. The Saudis and the Bushes are extremely incestuous.
Well, certainly I'm sure
you know that already.
Well, and there's, you know, excellent work by Greg Palast that shows the connection between the Bush family and the Bin Laden family. But, you know, try to take it to a higher level. You know, during the time when you were maybe directly connected to Dr. Fuse of the CIA and feeling that he was specifically interested in the Terry Anderson case and the Lockerbie case and seeing him as at least somewhat sympathetic to the truth as that you've represented it so far, according to those events, you know, where do we put you and he, and when you see Bush sitting there in the classroom and wonder what he's thinking during the attacks, and as you've also represented Saddam Hussein, one maybe has to wonder what he's thinking during the attacks, like maybe he's being set up. I mean, what were people thinking during that time, really, at a high level?
That's a very good, you have very good questions. Here's some things about Richard Fuse. Richard Fuse and Daddy Bush had a huge altercation because Richard was one of the people who had he's actually the one, and his team located the hostages in Beirut. Not just pursued them, but actually found them. It was his team that located the buildings, the specific hostage takers, the guards over them, and Richard had called in the Delta Force in May or June, and Daddy Bush called it off and forced the hostages to wait until October. And then it was the original October surprise when right before the election, the hostage, Delta Force went in and rescued the hostages and the Terry Anderson. And that was all, they actually had been located months before and had gotten screwed over and had been held like 6 months longer. So for Daddy Bush's election.
Yeah,
Wow.
Well, I mean, that's terrible. And these people were being tortured. They were in chains. They had no. I mean, they were chained to in tiny little rooms without any toilets. I mean, they had to use a bucket to use the bathroom. They were in peril of their lives. George Bush Sr. did not care. All he cared about was, I'm going to get campaign coverage out of this. I'm going to get elected. And so Richard Fuse is actually one of the good guys. Richard Fuse had also gone after Ollie North, and was one of the nemesis of Ollie North, and had been involved in like his prosecution on Iran-Contra. That does not mean that he was sympathetic to the Sandinistas. He wasn't, but he was very angry about the shipping of cocaine and the whole Iran angle. That was Richard's thing. Richard was involved in Iran as well. So he was involved in exposing those people. So he's actually one of the good guys. But what that means is that when you get because I am associated with him, his enemies become my enemies by default. And I don't necessarily know who they are, even though I'm being attacked. Do you see?
So, my mind is blank on
that. So the people who...
Can clarify this a little bit? Now, you were directly involved with Dr. Fuse during his altercation with Bush Sr., during the time when the Delta Force was called off.
That was in the 80s.
Okay, so that predates
your
relationship.
I met Richard in 94. He's a good guy. I mean, he's one of the people who, he's ruthless. This is what I always explain to people. These are some ruthless men, but he stands for principles even though he's being ruthless about it. And, you know, these are people who really will fight to the death. And they do. But the thing is, Richard has good values. Richard is on the good side of all these issues.
Is he still...
He's not one of the bad guys.
So he's still around and still active?
Well, he's actually retired now. He's probably about 68 or 69 years old.
But how do you retire from that? I find that
very carefully.
Yeah, my personal opinion is they come and they kill you.
And he's not been assassinated.
It's like the mafia. You're in it till you're dead.
But he's survived because he's very graceful and diplomatic.
Well, he survived because he's very rich and he can afford good attorneys. But that's because he made a fortune from the Saudis. I mean,
So how does this now tie into the situation of what you got caught up in the pre-Iraq war?
What happened with me was I had, back in 2004, I had gone to, I had come out very strongly against the war. From the start of the Bush administration, our team had been doing direct work with the Iraqi government to force them to comply with the United Nations weapons inspections, and we did the preliminary, overseen by Richard, supervised by Dr. Fuse. I had been in direct contact with the Iraqi officials and ambassadors and diplomats on securing Iraq's compliance with the weapons inspections. And I was also doing the anti-terrorism work, so I was doing both of those things. The other thing that we were working on was, again at Richard's insistence, was that we would get contracts for American corporations at the level that they had prior to the first Gulf War. So we were trying to get, even though the sanctions, I was a passionate anti-sanctions activist. I was fiercely opposed to the sanctions, so I was in an extremely good position to do this. And I was in a rather unique position to argue that American corporations should be given contracts even though the United States had supported the sanctions. But that's what the United States wanted. We were, at that point, we were more than first among equals. We were a superpower, and we could pretty much dictate anything we wanted, and they would have to give it to us. So here's what the Iraqis were willing to give us, and I think you should consider this. It's very relevant to what's happening right now as an either-or kind of thing. You've seen what has happened. We've ended up in bankruptcy. We've ended up, our automobile industry is collapsing. Our telecommunications industries are collapsing. Everything is falling. Financially, we're doomed.
Sure.
And the Iraqis had offered to buy one versus what could have been. This is the what could have been. Iraq had offered to buy 1 million American-made automobiles from Ford, Chrysler, General Motors every year for 10 years. And that would have been 10 million automobiles, a steady supply of demand, a steady demand. It would have meant thousands of jobs, union jobs, high-paying quality jobs for working Americans. It would have fed Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, all the states that are collapsing right now. The Iraqis also offered to give preferential contracts to American telecommunications firms and American healthcare suppliers and pharmaceutical companies ahead of everybody else. And the other thing that would surprise you is that Iraq was offering to give preferential contracts to American oil companies. We never had to go to war for oil because the Iraqis would have given us everything. They would have given us priority in oil development, oil exploration. They would have guaranteed our supplies and quotas. They wanted it so badly that they were like, look, you don't have to invade us. You can have the oil. We'll invite your corporations in. But George Bush was like insane. People say to me all the time, why did we go to war? If we didn't have to do it for the oil, why do it at all? And and there are two reasons, of course. Daddy Bush, I'm convinced this was a vendetta to try to avenge Daddy Bush and to show his father that he could be this great man. And the second thing was that the Caspian pipeline, I am convinced that the only strategic value for having bases in Iraq is to watch over the Caspian pipeline, which goes from Kazakhstan down through Iran. And we're afraid of what Iran is going to do, so we set up bases inside Iraq. And that is one thing that we could never have done with Saddam in power. That is probably the only thing that we would never have been allowed to do. But we could have had the oil. But we couldn't have had the basis.
What would you say to those who assert that this other stuff was going to happen, the Iraqis did offer it, we could have got it either way, war or no war, but there was also the raiding of artifacts in museums, libraries. Do you have any comment on that angle?
That was done in the looting,
right,
after the invasion.
Right, but would they have been able to get access to it otherwise?
Oh, that's a good question. They could not have gotten access to it. So, yes, if the West wanted to seize the artifacts from Iraq, unfortunately, if that was their intention, they have bungled it very badly, because what has happened is that the looters got there first, and they just carried off treasures from Sumeria and Mesopotamia and Persia, those things have disappeared. In fact, there is rumored to be a top-level imam, a Shiite, who has hoarded a lot of that collection and is allegedly selling it off to pay for jihad in Iraq. Like all the fighting against the United States soldiers, is apparently part of the funding is coming from the sale of the antiquities. And it's being done by Shiite imams who are selling it off to make money to buy guns.
Okay, this might be a silly question, but just to get it out of the way, I mean, are we naive to assume that there may be something as valuable that it may preempt, as you say, the willingness to buy American autos, to give preferential contracts to telecom, pharmaceuticals, oil, in a similar way to what the Nazis were interested during their reign when they went all over the world trying to find all kinds of ancient artifacts. You mentioned that word. Do you have any specific intelligence that would enlighten us a little bit about why they may or may not be valuable at all?
Well, I think that, you mean like were they hunting for a holy grail kind of thing? I think that Bush, I really think that Bush this may not satisfy the people who, the soldiers who are out there who are dying or who are wondering why the heck was I sent over there. I think that at this point the government does not even know why it's in this war. I think that I think that it's that sad that I don't even think George Bush knows why he's there anymore. The group think mentality was dominating Washington during that period right before the invasion, and they had isolated themselves and they had insulated themselves, and they were removing themselves from any contact from people who were opposed to the war. So you had, you know, you could turn on the TV and you could see that one in every eight citizens in Spain was marching on a single day. They had millions of people on the streets of Spain, like 13 million people. That one of every eight citizens was protesting on the street, and George Bush pretended not to see it. Italy was another supporter of the war, and their populations took to the streets by the millions. We had demonstrations in Washington, demonstrations in New York. The streets were crowded with people. The letters to Congress were running 10 to 1 against war. 400,000 letters a week were arriving in Washington telling them not to go to war. 400,000 a week. And yet, George Bush is like, everybody gave me bad information. I'm not responsible for this horrible, stupid, terrible mistake. Those guys did it. Well, who are those guys? Me? I was the asset involved with Iraq. There were three of us, Melody, mm-hmm. Three assets covered the Iraqi embassy, and all three of us got arrested. Here you have George Bush telling everybody, well, it's the assets who did it. But then I got arrested because I told him, because I did tell my cousin, who was the chief of staff to George Bush, so I had unique access. I had a cousin who was his chief of staff. And I said, Cousin Andy Card, this is a catastrophe. For the love of God, don't do it. Don't do this. It will be a disaster. I told them that Iran would emerge as a major regional power, that Al-Qaeda would rise from its grave and be refreshed with new recruits. I said that we could solve all the problems and get everything the United States wanted without firing a shot. And here's another thing that people, this part of it you may not believe when I say, but there was talk of Saddam stepping down even when I was in Baghdad. He was a pragmatist. He was a survivor. And he would have disembarked if it would have meant saving his own life. And I do believe that. And people may say they don't agree with me, and that's okay. But I think that Saddam would have stepped down without going to war. And that's a very unpopular opinion, but I do think it's true. I don't think anybody in Washington even knows why they're there anymore.
This is Janet. Can I pipe in for a
second? Go ahead.
Yeah. As I listen to Susan, it becomes clearer to me, not that they don't know why they're there, but the reasons that they are there, the reasons that the United States has invaded Iraq, were absolutely compelling reasons, but not what we were told by the mainstream media and not what we were told by the alternative media in terms of oil. I have, you know, felt for a very long time, and I've been saying for a very long time that the oil beating the oil drum is a false path to take. And what Susan states concerning the concessions Iraq was willing to make very clearly validate that since we were going to be getting the oil, it really isn't the oil that we're after there. Now, I think that any event that is so impelled as this war in Iraq has been impelled by the administration, there is a reason here. The reason has not been made clear to us. I think sometimes it's helpful to use different paradigms and look at the world maybe in different ways than we are accustomed to. And it appears that we're in some sort of global chess game right now. And that the United States needed Iraq for something.
I think it goes back.
If it wasn't oil, mm-hmm. and if it wasn't, you know, the artifacts is something that, you know, I have some questions about that. I mean, I Susan certainly knows far more about that than I do. But there's something there, and if it is a move in a geopolitical chess game,
I think
then that move was certainly taken.
I agree with you on that, but I also are you familiar with the PNAC documents, and
mm-hmm.
and what those stated? I mean, Iraq was just one of numerous places that they were going to go through, and it appears that they have gone through, you know, a number of those countries already,
mm-hmm.
and are working their way through them.
Right.
Was it that elementary, or Janet? Do you actually suspect something you're not saying yet?
Well, I had an interesting interview on the radio show I had on KSKQ in Ashland, Oregon, before I left the country last September. I had a very interesting interview with a fellow named Jeff Golden, who is sort of a local icon and luminary. He was a radio talk show host on the local NPR affiliate. He had been, I believe, a commissioner, county commissioner. He had been an activist. He'd written a whole bunch of books, and he had written a book that I had interviewed him on called Unafraid, which was a novel of the possible. What if JFK had survived the assassination in Dealey Plaza and went on to become this wonderful president, and the whole world changed? And the book opens on September 11th of 2001, and there's no terrorist attack on the United States. And in the middle of the interview, we got into this stuff about Iraq, and Jeff was, you know, giving certain scenarios, which I frankly found implausible, and I said, well, look, we have invaded Iraq, and we've taken over Iraq. And he goes, oh, no, well, they have their own government. And I said, blah, 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 and we're going to withdraw. And I said, look, you seize the resources, and you set up a puppet government. You have basically taken over that country. You have basically, you know, like a big blob, you swallowed it up. You know, you may have the Iraqi legislature and this and that, but if these people are controlled, if they are controlled by the United States, if the resources and assets are also now controlled by the United States, you have an annexed, in a sense, a state.
It's a colonial occupation.
You know, Susan.
Well, it's an occupation or a takeover.
Yes.
Susan,
right.
You had said something about the, the article that I was reading, but if you were being an activist and you were against the sanctions, then somehow the UN was tied in there. What was your affiliation with the UN?
My work was being done as an asset All my work was done at the United Nations with embassies and diplomats and ambassadors at the United Nations. So I was dealing directly with high-level diplomats, and a lot of my diplomatic contacts were on the Security Council, and they were involved, you know, and my entree to them was through the sanctions issue. So some people, I realize it a little that perhaps some people would think that it's bad for an anti-war activist and an anti-sanctions activist to have done this kind of thing. It's certainly a little bit controversial. But what it allowed me to do was to work against violence. And I was working against terrorism, but I was not against people. I was not against governments. I was not against religions. I was against violence itself. And so I was, the United Nations was where we set up the back channel, because we were getting the information from the governments. These are the governments that have the stuff. And if you're not dealing with that, see, here's the problem with shutting off diplomacy and shutting off communications. Those are the people who really know what's going on. And if you're trying to get anything accomplished in terrorism, you've got to communicate with them, because otherwise you don't know what, you're blindsided.
Okay, so what do you attribute the UN's real role of being in there?
I'm sorry, could you talk a little louder?
What do you attribute the UN's real role of being there in Iraq? Do you really feel that it was about the sanctions?
Oh, I think the United Nations was horrible. I am truly opposed to sanctions, and the sanctions in Iraq caused tremendous suffering. Iraq lost 2 million citizens who died from the sanctions, from malnutrition and lack of medicines. Iraq went from a country that performed the second heart transplant in the entire world. In history, they performed the second heart transplant to a country that had no aspirin. And when I was in Baghdad, I saw little children who were dying, who were in such hideous pain, they couldn't even give them an aspirin, let alone morphine, to kill their pain. And also because of the depleted uranium in Iraq, which was left over from the first Gulf War, left behind by the United States, mind you, they say. Cancer is like the flu in children. It's an epidemic. Here in the United States, there is some cancer among children, and it's tragic when it happens. But there, it's like every family has a child that's dying of cancer. Every single family has one. And they say cancer is like the flu. And it shouldn't be that way. But, you know, what we have done what we did to Iraq is something. I mean, I don't know if you believe in God or not, but I say we have to answer to God for this, because this is just, it's so much worse than what the average American citizen understands. And then we're surprised when they're attacking us. There is no way that we could have done what we did to them for 13 years and then expect that they wouldn't hate us with everything they've got as soon as
we arrived.
Wait
a second, you're saying that Iraq attacked us?
That Iraq hated us.
No, you said
and then once we got to Iraq, that the insurgency would just, to expect that there would be no insurgency is just ridiculous. We, you know, this was very easy to see this coming. You can't do the things that we did to those people and then be surprised when they fight back. They would never have welcomed us there. That was very, very foolish of the United States to think that that would happen.
Can I kind of throw in a kind of a weird scenario? But I see that it isn't just taking place in Iraq, but it's kind of like the UN plays this role, and it's almost like a role-playing scenario, where it becomes like the Hegelian dialectic between them and us when we go into these countries. And and at the same time, they're playing off each other kind of like the Republicans and the Democrats play off each other.
And some say it's happening exactly as planned. Right? I mean, a lot of this stuff is obvious, and I think that maybe what Melody's show is about is leaving a lot of the obvious to the daytime thing. And now here we are, we have you both here, and you seem to both agree that maybe Jeff Golden and other people's assumptions that, you know, we had this government installed and they were ready to go democracy, maybe that's a little naive. We hear a little exasperatory exclamation from Susan when Janet describes that. So, you know, insofar as you agree on that and find that that's implausible, what is the underlying suspicions then? We're talking to someone who's been an asset in Iraq and who the government has trusted and the military supposedly has trusted to tell us information. So tell us the information. What's underneath here that, like Melody says, is part of the plan where, you know, the UN's being perhaps used and it's really not expected, according to PNAC documents, that Iraq doesn't hate us. That, in fact, is part of the plan. I mean, aren't we all in agreement in some way that there's something underneath, and why don't we just roll it out for you guys to lay out some of your suspicions to what that is?
Well, I will.
Okay, go ahead.
I would be glad to. I think we have entered a phase where the people in power want global unification. Iraq was not compliant in certain aspects of what is being set up worldwide.
Oh, good, Janet.
And just not compliant. And therefore had to be demonized, had to be attacked, had to be rolled over, with a tank, so to speak, in order to be reduced to rubble so that the issues in which Iraq has not been compliant, the invading force will move in, tweak the issues so that Iraq is compliant, and then we will, you know, having set up the government of our choosing, we will withdraw. It will look like we have withdrawn, when actually what we did is we went in there and we tweaked what needed to be tweaked so that the geographical area which, you know, we call Iraq will now be compliant in terms of what is being rolled out in terms of global unification. And some of it is real nasty. If not all of it. Looks nice, looks like democracy, it's called democracy, it's called liberating people.
We didn't liberate those people. I mean,
no.
Listen.
Well, we liberated them from life. We liberated them from life, okay?
Yeah,
a lot of them we simply got off the planet.
Yeah.
But if it, you know, we use words that are palatable and that people will find acceptable. The fact is, Iraq was not compliant on certain issues that are necessary for this global unification that is being planned. Some people call it the New World Order, global unification, whatever words you want to use. Non-compliant, go in there, do what needs to be done, and don't let people know what it really is. Call it a war on terror. Call it a, you know, for people who see through that real quick, call it a grab for oil. Call it whatever you want to, but don't tell people what it is.
Okay, well, let me go ahead and do our what we have to do for the legally, and that's to say that this is TruthQuest Radio, and I'm interviewing Susan Lindauer and Janet Phelan, and my co-host with me tonight, Melody, is Shannon, and it's now 10 o'clock, and this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and support for KHEN and TruthQuest is brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Property Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at coloradohomeproperty.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. Susan, did you have anything to add to that?
I think that Janet has just hit something very well. The global unification and the global chess game, I think that has I would add to that that I think that the pipeline from the Kazakhstan to Iran and setting up the military bases in Iraq so that they have a launching point to protect that pipeline, I think that it is all about protecting corporations, big corporations, not protecting people. Democracy is it's very clear that democracy is a threat to these people. They use that for lip service, but they don't like it. They don't really want democracy in our world because democracy would challenge them. They want to be able to consolidate their power and to give us, you know, they're going to choose the candidates, they're going to choose the outcomes, and we're just going to kind of rubber stamp them and they're going to, you know, pacify us and pretend that we're contributing. But they don't want our contributions.
You say chess game. Now, that brings to mind the big new Brzezinski. And do you think he has any part in why this is being played out like it is? Are you familiar with him? No?
Are you allowed to mention his name?
You know, I don't know who you're asking. I am familiar with him, but I'm not as conversant with him that I could respond adequately to that question. So I'm passing on that.
Okay, can we... you mentioned some of the affiliations that you had earlier, and you mentioned Libya, Yemen, Egypt,
Syria. I did the Lockerbie negotiations with Libya.
Do you have any?
Sometimes I get accused of grandiosity, and I totally deny that. I worked extremely hard in anti-terrorism for 9 years. And my bona fides in anti-terrorism are if I may say so myself, are extremely good. If I had been allowed to have a trial, it would have turned out that I warned about the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993. And that's how the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency actually found me. Because I warned about that attack, and I warned an embassy about that attack. I didn't know who to go to, so I went to the Tunisians, because they represented Yasser Arafat, and I thought Yasser Arafat's people would probably know what to do, and I didn't know what to do. So this is actually how they really come to find me. And then after that I did, Richard Fuse asked me if I would establish, they came to me and they said, hey, you seem to know how to do this anti-terrorism stuff. Would you establish, and you're anti-sanctions, so would you establish contact with Libya and try to get the Lockerbie trial? And so I actually, it was super heavily supervised by the United States. I have to stress that this passes what I call the Aunt Susie test. My Aunt Susie lives in Arizona, and she's retired, and she's very conservative, and she would be like, oh, dear Lord, my niece is off doing this crazy stuff. But everything that I did was being heavily supervised. They would never have turned an American citizen loose and just cut you loose to go do stuff. They were controlling my every move. And I did Libya with, I did the, I warned about, I got information from the Iraqis about the bombing of the USS Cole, and I alerted my friends in Yemen, at the deputy ambassador of Yemen at the United Nations, and the Security Council was a friend of mine. I alerted the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. That information came from the Iraqi diplomats. In fact, Iraq was one of our best sources on anti-terrorism. Everything you've been told about how Saddam Hussein was promoting terrorism or maybe he was engaged with Al-Qaeda, that's ridiculous. He hated the fundamentalists. It was part of his plan to use cooperation with anti-terrorism to try to build a bridge back into the United States and to try to rebuild the alliance with the United States that existed before his invasion of Kuwait. So, he was always feeding us really good quality intelligence on terrorism.
I think we're hearing you on that. My question has more to do with, are you getting any feedback And now I have two questions.
Okay, from, I'm sorry.
From Libya, Yemen, Egypt, or Syria, which you all mentioned, and I'd be interested to know, I mean, here we are four Americans discussing it. What information did you get feedback, if any, from those? And then the second question, which just popped up, is what did your cousin Andrew Card give you as feedback when you called him?
Feedback for, you're asking feedback on Libya from where? On which issue?
Well, we're conjecturing, and you know, this is not a court, and your bona fides are you know, duly noted. But you know, here we are, and it's past 10 o'clock out here in Colorado, and you go here, you know, here's your hall pass to go ahead and conjecture what, you know, we've stated or heard from you what we thought maybe Americans and the CIA was being fed as far as information about this and what Saddam Hussein's actual position was versus what the American media represented him as. But what kind of information, if any, did you get back when you contacted the deputy ambassador in Yemen or any of the other four
Arab
states?
Were always extremely grateful. We had, it was considered, well, first of all, when I went to the deputy ambassador of Yemen, we had dinner in New York 5 days before the attack on the USS Cole, and I could not tell him how I knew that information. It did come from the Iraqis, but given the politics of Iraq at the United Nations at that point, I could not tell him where I got it. I remember I showed up in ragged jeans. I had been traveling all day, and I was like, we got to talk right now. And I made him take me out to dinner. He was dressed in his business suit, very, you know, very fine Armani, and I was in, you know, torn jeans. And I was like, it doesn't matter. I've got to tell you this. But he never knew where it came from. But then 5 days later, it happened, and it happened exactly like I told him it was going to, as an attack on the port facility. And we had talked before the attack about how Yemen would respond, should respond, in the event such a thing happened, and what specific actions they needed to take immediately in order to reassure the United States that they were not going, you know, that they were fully compliant and cooperative. Because one of the things, this may or may not interest you, but Osama, the reason that the Iraqi diplomats had explained to me why the Iraqi diplomats told me what the attack would be, and they also told me why the attack was going to take place. And the Iraqis were very interested in why the attack was taking place, because Yemen is the poor, very poor, dirt poor, next door neighbor of Saudi Arabia. And Yemen feels that Yemen tribes believe that Saudi Arabia stole their land and their oil, and that if Saudi Arabia was not so greedy, then Yemen would not be so poor. So Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda crowd originally wanted to set up base in Yemen so that they would have a foothold to attack the Saudi oil fields, and that they recognized that they would have great sympathies among the Yemeni people, who would probably shelter them like the Pakistanis are doing right now. So they tried to move from Somalia into Yemen, and the United States has actually pushed them out of Yemen into Somalia to stop. But you notice that if you look in the Gulf of Aden, Somalia is right across the water from Yemen. So these guys have been trying to get into Yemen, which would be disastrous. They didn't know, you know, I could not tell the deputy ambassador of Yemen that it was from the Iraqis for different reasons. But Yemen is very much aware that it's got a real problem, and they deserve a lot of credit, because if they were to go with Osama and the Al-Qaeda crowd, they would be like, it'd be a disaster.
Susan.
Let's just put it that way.
Susan.
They could cause a lot of problems.
Susan, what it brings up to me, I mean, because we haven't yet to get into what your real dilemma is right here, but what seems to come to mind to me is, you know, all the information that you had brought out was already brought out. So I'm thinking they think you have more information or it's going to be brought out in any kind of trial. Is that a take you might have?
Oh, I think that's true.
Because, I mean, you seem to have a broad knowledge of a lot more than just what was going on in that one area.
So, oh, yeah.
And you seem to be tied to a number of different events that are quite significant that have never been totally resolved either, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So why don't you get into what's going on and what you've been treated like after you were arrested?
Yeah. I will. What happened to me after I was arrested was, first of all, the fact that I was arrested at all was, to me, was quite shocking. I was blown away by it. I guess in retrospect, I should have been prepared. But it was not what I was expecting to happen. I had gone to, back in February, I was arrested in March of 2004. In February 2004, 1 month prior to my arrest, I had gone, President Bush had just appointed the Presidential Commission on Iraqi Pre-War Intelligence, co-chaired by John McCain. Dear John McCain. And I had lots of family in Arizona. My father lives there. My brother lives there. My aunts, uncles, cousins. My grandmother and grandfather were pioneers in Arizona back at the turn of the century. And so I had gone to Senator McCain's office and told him that I wanted to testify to tell the truth and tell the full story about Iraqi pre-war intelligence, which has not been told. I mean, the stuff about the oil, I mean, there's so many misconceptions that even if I just tell you, like, surface stuff, it's still different than what you guys have been taught. You know, many people are not as sophisticated as you are, so they're just not even willing to hear it. In the mainstream media, they don't want to know it at all. But 1 month after I went to John McCain's office, I was indicted. And I woke up one morning, I heard banging on my door, and lo and behold, it's the FBI. And I'm like, what are you doing here? Why am I being arrested? You are kidding me. You know, what's the charge? You know? And the guy was so surprised that I was surprised that he started shaking. And he was like, well, I'll tell you when we get to the office. And I was like, well, don't you think that somebody who's being arrested by the FBI should at least have a clue, like an inkling, as to the fact that, you know, that they might have broken the law somewhere. Anyway, at the time of my arrest, there was a huge amount of outcry from the media, because my cousin was the chief of staff to George Bush. So the media was very interested in my relationship to him. And then he got hold of the media and said, oh, no, don't cover this story anymore. Let this story die. And everybody thought that they were going to, like, let me go and that they were going to drop the case. That's not what they did. 18 months after my arrest, Judge Michael Mukasey, whom you all would know as the United States Attorney General, ordered that I should go to a Texas military base, a women's prison called Carswell, which is located outside of Fort Worth, Texas, on a naval air base, and that I should be forced to undergo a psychiatric evaluation to determine if I was competent to stand trial or if I could be made competent to stand trial. Now, I'm like, well, if I warned about 9/11, how am I incompetent? If I did the negotiations with Libya on the Lockerbie, how am I incompetent? If I did the preliminary talks with the Iraqis on the weapons inspections, how am I incompetent? If I told you war was a disaster, and it is, then how am I wrong? You know, I'm right about everything. Why are you blaming me? Because that was the story that George Bush wanted to tell. George Bush you know, for I think it's cowardice. The worst sort of cowardice is for politicians in Washington to force this kind of thing on the country when the whole world and all the American people were opposed to the war, and then to refuse to take responsibility for the fact that they're the idiots who made the mistake. But anyway, yes, I ended up getting arrested. I was sent to a Texas military base for a phony psych evaluation, and they actually asked the court for permission to forcibly drug me with Haldol until I could be cured of saying that I had warned about 9/11 and that I would stop telling what I knew about Iraqi pre-war intelligence.
And you didn't do that.
It's really quite a terrifying experience that I went through. I have to reassure everybody, I never actually used any drugs. I told them to go to hell. I said, I absolutely will not do that. And they said, well, we would, if you agree to do it, then we'll let you go. And I said, oh, no. Oh, no, no, no. I have no intention of cooperating with that at all. There's no way. There's just no way. And they admitted in court, because your listening audience will want to know this, they admitted in court that in 7 months of detention at Carswell, they saw no evidence of hallucinations, no evidence of schizophrenia, no evidence of hearing voices, no depression. I was highly motivated. I walked 4 to 6 miles a day on the track. I worked at the law library. I was terrified, mind you. I was very frightened at this. By this point, I was getting really scared. I was supposed to be released in February, and then they refused to release me. So first of all, I'm sent to prison without a trial and a conviction, and then the government, the courts, and the prison refused to let me go home. And that's a very frightening thing.
Can I say one other thing is, what happened to the two other assets?
Ah, very good question. They were held in prison. At the time, I was able to make bail because I own a house, and so I put up my house as bail. They did not have any such luxuries, and they were foreigners, and they were considered flight risks. They were Iraqi. They were the sons of Iraqi diplomats. They were 24-year-olds who had worked at a dry cleaner's, and they were the sons of diplomats who wanted to stay in the United States after the invasion. And so the United States had said, well, if you'll help us with pre-war intelligence, and if you'll, they would take photographs and videos of people who visited the embassy, and then they would give the videos to the FBI. And so, you know, the FBI kind of traded with them to get this information, and then they got arrested. They were in prison for 18 months, and then they were deported to Tunisia with a forced non-disclosure agreement, on condition that if they ever broke the non-disclosure agreement, they would be arrested in Tunisia.
So what about their families?
Their families, as ambassadors, their families had more leeway. They were not welcome in Iraq, so they had also gone to Tunisia. Different Arab countries took different diplomats. Like, for example, the former ambassador, Al-Duri, ended up in the Emirates.
And that was the entirety of American intelligence assets in Iraq, just the three of you.
I'm sorry, what?
Just the three of you represented the entirety of American assets for the CIA in Iraq.
Well, we were covering the embassy. So here's the problem with what we did. The United States was very stupid. According to testimony on Capitol Hill, inside Iraq, in the part that was not controlled in the Kurdish territory, outside of the Kurdish territory, they said that they could count on one hand the number of agents and assets helping the United States. One hand.
Do you believe that?
I think that's true. I can tell you that the pressure on me as an asset covering the United Nations was intense. I had to do every you know, there was not a division of labor where you had different people covering different facets of stuff. I had to be an expert on a whole bunch of different things tied to Iraq. And my basis was anti-terrorism, but I had to take on, you know, the financial contracts for American corporations. I had to take on the weapons inspection stuff. And there just wasn't, you know, the sanctions and refusing to have dialogue cost the United States dearly. It really is not a good policy. It's even if you don't like we hated the Soviet Union, but this is what I used to hear from the United Nations all the time. We hated the Soviet Union, we did, but we still had their embassies in Washington D.C. because we had to communicate with each other because we did hate each other so much, and we got into a different kind of situation with Iraq and some of these Arab countries, where we're losing dialogue with the people that we have to know what they're really doing. Did you see what I'm saying? It is crippling us to be blinded and to have no awareness of what they're really doing and what, you know, it's a disaster.
Okay, so with your treatment, I mean, you're facing going back in, and why is that?
Well, I ended up staying in prison for a year. After my release from prison, I had been promised that the charges would be dropped. That was what my attorney, my horrible public defender attorney told me at the time that I was sent in. He said, look, you know, you're not taking a plea bargain, you're not having a trial, but if we find you incompetent, then you will never have a conviction. You will get out of this thing unscathed. Yes, they're going to hurt your reputation. Oh well, you know, who cares? You know, at least you won't have a federal conviction on your, a felony conviction on your record. And I was like, well, that sucks. You know, I'm not happy with that. But, you know, but he had done it already, and it was something that was being imposed on me. Anyway, I was held for a year, then released, and they discovered that they could not drop the charges against me because I do know too much, and I know too many different things, as you were saying earlier, and it's not what the government wants people to know about. It's not the perspective. It's like George Bush has like a kaleidoscope, and he's twisted things around, and I bring things back into clarity, and I bring things that's like, no, that's not what happened. This is what happened. No, that's wrong. This is right. And they don't want you to have that information, even if it just is if it's just a little bit off center, if their perspective is just a little bit off center, they don't want you to have the real facts.
Susan, would it help our audience for you to tell us that there's some limit, that there are some things you cannot tell us, or are you saying to us that you're at liberty at this point to tell us anything that you do know?
Well, I'm telling you what I'm at liberty to tell you, but I mean, there's, you know, if we were to, if I was to write a book or something, I would have, you know, details and details and chapters on the stuff. I mean, so I'm kind of giving you like a block summary of something that, you know,
this is one thing that's always kind of struck me, is that I've listened to numerous people that are kind of in your position, and it doesn't matter whether they're working as part of their job or whatever, military, whatever. They have when they're whistleblowing, they only tell part of the truth, even though their life is threatened. And
right.
What makes them stop and still have some bit of integrity when it's already been proven to you that they have none?
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? I actually live near Walter Reed. That's a very good question. Hmm. And I can tell you my answer. Walter Reed is the medical center where injured Iraqi soldiers, American soldiers who've been fighting in Iraq, are coming back to. And on the streets of my neighborhood, you know, where I live, in my little community, I'm apt to see amputees, people who are, you know, young 25-year-olds who are blind. I don't think that I had ever seen anybody who was an amputee who was 25 years old, or somebody who was blind who was 25 years old. And these are clearly people who were not born blind, but who have become handicapped because of this war. And it really does make you stop and think. Like, for a long time, I stayed quiet just because I thought, dear God, do I have the right to tell them that they lost all their lives for nothing?
I've interviewed several people that have worked around that whole situation, and it really is disgusting what's happened to them, and it's been an ongoing situation. It isn't just this war; it's been war after war after war. Do you have anything to say about the Valerie Plame situation?
Valerie Plame's got nothing on me. She's whining as far as I'm concerned. She didn't go through anything like what I went through.
But you still have that possibly to happen yet. So you have something that they don't want out, obviously.
Well, but think about what I've told you even tonight. If you had, like, if I were to write a book and to analyze how many thousands of jobs would be created in the automobile industry at a time when they're in bankruptcy, and it would have meant hundreds of millions of dollars in revenues every year, billions of dollars in revenues. It would have meant, you know, it would have produced jobs right down the line with multipliers for auto parts and supplies and repairs and shipping and exports, and it would have affected the balance of trade. And all of these things could have been positives for the United States, which is now going, you know, our economy's going down the toilet, and we may not recover from this. And it's all because of this war that never had to be fought, that was totally avoidable. And I think that the politicians don't even know why they did this war. I think that to some extent we're trying to figure out why they were stupid, and I don't even think they know the answer anymore. I think that they thought they looked tough, and I think that it's as simple as the Democrats wanted to look as tough as the Republicans, and they were in this race with each other. And they had no idea what they were doing, and now they're facing the aftermath of it, and it's a disaster.
Okay, so they don't know the truth, but this is Truth Quest, so who does know?
Oh, I'll tell you something. I do not believe that. I do not believe that they don't know why they're there. I have to speak to that. And one thing I want to say is if Susan goes on trial, then the entire policy and lies and propaganda that was laid out to the American people to put us into Iraq goes on trial too.
Okay, now that makes total sense. That makes total sense. And as far as you speaking out at this point in time, and as you feel like it's crucial just for your ability to for protection, essentially, correct?
I think Janet is totally correct.
Uh-huh.
I think that's totally correct. I think that the rationale for the going on to yes, entirely. I think she said it very well.
Well, kind
but
of.
I think that it's the clarity question that becomes important, because I think that, you know, that. You know, if you untwist, it's like a Rubik's Cube or something. If you untwist it, then it may look simple to have untwisted it, but actually it's kind of a mess to get it untwisted. I've been trying to get a trial for 5 years, and they have fought desperately to deny me a trial. The only time I was allowed to have any witnesses come into court immediately, the first witness we called verified that I warned about 9/11. And I was never, and that we were supposed to have a second hearing 10 days later. And they, the prosecution and the judge postponed it for 4 months, and they postponed it 7 times. And then, when we had the second hearing, we had a defense psychiatrist testify. He said, there's nothing wrong with me, of course. He said that there's no basis for saying that I'm incompetent, that it's ridiculous. And the judge had already written a decision, and as soon as the testimony ended, the judge read the decision into the record saying, nope, we're not going to let Susan Lindauer have a trial.
Okay, two questions. One of them is, why do you think they just didn't let you go? And the other one is what do you think of Mukasey?
Well, the first thing I want to say is the new judge is married to her husband, works for the law firm that handles George Bush Sr. And that firm
is what?
I'd have to look it up in the internet. But her husband her husband works at the law firm that represents Daddy Bush. I should have that at my fingertips, and I will get it at my fingertips next time. But he does. The second thing is that 5 days before she issued her decision against me, amazingly enough, she was appointed to the appellate court, and just 5 days before she gave her decision that I should not be allowed to have a trial. And so it's like somebody called her on the phone and said, hey, guess what? And by the way, that Susan Lindauer case, we really don't want that going anywhere. And then what do I think of Mukasey? I think that Mukasey was very sophisticated and savvy, and he recognized that he tried to play it both ways. And I think that he stopped them from, in the end, I'm very grateful that he stopped them from forcibly drugging me. And I think he was far smarter than they thought. I think that they thought that he would rubber stamp anything that they wanted. And in the end, he saved me. So I'm grateful for that.
Well, you would think that they would want some of their assets out there thinking they were a little bit safe.
Right.
I'm sorry, I can hardly hear you.
You would think that they would want some of their assets out there thinking they were a little bit safe.
Oh, yeah. Well, I tell you, it's a terribly stupid, short-sighted thing, because within the community that I'm in, people know what happened. And, I mean, I realize that, you know, out there in Colorado and, you know, you guys don't necessarily know what happened to me. But within this community here in Washington, you know, people do know what happened. And they're like, ooh, that is ugly. And it sends a potent and destructive message that you better not stick your neck out. You better not take too many risks, because the politicians who are sending you out to go do stuff are going to bite you tomorrow.
In other words, their message is you tell us what we want to hear, or don't tell us anything.
Exactly. And that's a stupid policy. You don't ever want to be in that situation. That's exactly right.
Well, and this is a high-level discussion. A lot of people may not even know who Michael Mukasey is, you know? I mean, there's a lot here that's being glossed over. And one of the things is the discussion that you had with the deputy ambassador from Yemen about the USS Cole. Now, most of us probably have forgotten entirely about that the fact that it was supposedly a garbage barge with suicide bombers that blew a 40-foot hole in the side of the USS Cole by a guy, al-Nashiri, that we accused, but then apparently Yemen has had charged suspects, plural, separately in that case. And yet here you are telling us that you knew it was going to happen 5 days before, but you were not at liberty to tell the deputy ambassador. And for a person who's sitting here in Colorado hearing you say, I was a CIA asset, but I edited the truth when I talked...
Well, No. I couldn't tell him where I got the information. I couldn't tell him that it came from the Iraqis. But I did tell him what we knew from of the conspiracy to attack the ports. We told him to put it be on high alert in the port facilities, that there was definitely going to be an attack on the port facilities. But we didn't have enough info. Like I didn't, what I didn't did not have was the name of the individual, because that's not that the Iraqis didn't send that information to the diplomat, or the diplomat wouldn't give that to me.
Do you
but
now
we
believe
knew why they were doing it? We knew what the purpose which was to destabilize Yemen's relationship to the United States.
Certainly, but do you believe?
And we explained all of that to the guy. The only thing I did not tell him was that it came from the Iraqis.
And in your opinion, al-Nashiri was in collusion with bin Laden, as the U.S. government has alleged?
Yes.
And
yes,
that the
absolutely.
Suspects that were detained separately
because bin Laden was deliberately, before the, and I got to stress, this was in 2000, in October 2000, which was, a year before Osama became really, you know, considered a grave threat through 9/11. Osama at that point was trying to set up a base, was trying to knock out Yemen's relationship to the United States so that he could set up a base in Yemen from which to attack the Saudi oil fields.
But do you think Osama...
And so all of that was told to the Yemeni diplomat.
But do you think Osama...
We didn't hold anything back.
So are you saying you think Osama was really heavily involved with 9/11?
You know, I've been hearing that people don't think that he was. I think he was, yes. I think that doesn't mean that there wasn't more going on. It's like the Oklahoma City bombing. I've talked to people who are experts on... explosives and detonations, and they have said that the Oklahoma City attack, the Murrah building, could not have collapsed the way that it did unless there were explosives in the elevator shafts and in the stairwells. Because if it was a truck bomb, it would have taken out one side of the building. And it would have taken out a chunk of the building, but not the whole side of the building, just because of the way that the detonation would throw, would be thrown. But there had to be something rigged inside the building. And those are from people who are experts on explosives who are American. They're not Arabs. They're not, you know, conspiracy theorists. They're intelligence people who are experts on detonation. And I think that there may be more to 9/11 than just an airplane hitting the building. But obviously, the airplanes did hit the building. So, I mean, I think that it's kind of...
Well, Susan...
I think that we don't have to say that one didn't happen to say that something maybe more in addition didn't happen.
You've got... When is the date you're coming up for your next...
Next Monday.
Next Monday. Okay. Well, let's hope that you have some good news from that, and that, and I really appreciate you coming forward with this information. I can see that we could do another interview with you on a lot of different information here, and I would like to do so, but at the same time, I'd like to kind of bring forth Janet with the information that she has and why she has wanted to come on and speak about what she has been dealing with. Janet?
Yeah, hi, Melody. Well, you really have two women under siege on your show tonight. I did your show before. I think your listening audience, if you know, may be aware of some of the work I've done on biological and chemical weapons, particularly pertaining to Section 817 of the U.S. Patriot Act, how that relates. Specifically, my work has been on the water system as relating to 817, although I do believe that 817, which is authorizing the use of biological and chemical weapons against the United States of American citizens, I think that 817 really does is an umbrella statute that is authorizing several programs. I've also done reporting on what's happening in conservatorship court to the elderly and disabled who are, you know, having their assets seized and unfortunately dying before their time due to decisions being made by agents of the state. But recently, I got some more blowback. I had some blowback back around 2003. Things got pretty perilous back then. I was attacked by the police and almost died in January of 2003. I was in a coma for 2 days, and I'm not actually sure which angel breathed life into me, but I was not expected to survive. And, you know, I did, and I didn't get any satisfaction from, you know, from reports concerning the assault. My reports were disappeared, finessed, you know, I didn't get anywhere. So I just sort of picked myself up and kept working. And recently I was living in Medford, Oregon. I had been working as an investigative reporter at the American's Bulletin and started one radio show on KSKQ, which is also a low-power FM Pacifica affiliate, and ended up with a show on Republic Broadcasting Network. And I was doing some more digging around with the water records in Medford, Oregon. And I had discovered a public-private partnership between the City of Medford's Water Commission and the Lithia Corporation, which is one of the largest corporations really seated in Medford. And some really shocking records I was able to pull up. As usual, I had to develop a back door for blueprints because these city agencies redact information before they give it to you. And the redacted information didn't at all match, which, you know, the real records I was able to get. And just at the point where I was getting this story ready for print, there began to be some real police misconduct towards me. And it got to the point where it became very threatening. I mean, there was just, you know, there was the, yeah, there were the sneaks and peeks and so on. And I got used to, the fact that my home was being entered when I wasn't there. And, you know, I kind of got all the documents I really needed scanned. I put them on those little, you know, detachable hard drives. I really wasn't that worried about document theft. I figured, okay, you want to come in and, you know, ruffle through things, go ahead. You're not going to find anything that's, you know, that's really gonna, do much damage. So, but things started to get pretty bad. I had drugs planted in my home. People who know me know that I don't smoke cigarettes. I certainly don't use drugs. I actually don't take any pharmaceuticals whatsoever, legal or illegal. And I found a baggie of, looked like marijuana to me. I do remember marijuana back when I was 15 or 16. I was acquainted with marijuana, but I wasn't real interested in drugs, and I really sort of bypassed the whole drug culture. But there it was in my house. And, this is the third time I have found drugs planted in my house. And I must be, once again, very lucky because I seem to find the drugs before I am found with the drugs. So I did what I thought was the smart thing to do. I photographed the baggie. I went over to the bulletin office. I wrote up an affidavit about, you know, this seems to be a habit with you guys. Please protect me. I don't use drugs. I don't cultivate them. I don't sell them. I don't buy them, and so on. And then I figured, okay, I got that on file with the police department. They looked very uneasy about this, but I thought it was okay, and come to find several months later, I had to go over to the police to talk about something else, and I mentioned it and asked them to look up the report. There was no report. There was no affidavit.
There was no photograph of the evidence, and the dispatch call that I had made to contact the police had also been disappeared. So at that point, I began to feel distinctly uneasy, and I ended up talking about this on television in Medford and some other things. The police looked really bad, and they were kind of being maneuvered or forced, really, to pay attention to some of my complaints. But it didn't work. What they ended up doing was turning the investigation on me. And I was having records of mine were being subpoenaed, and it was just becoming... I do have evidence of some documents, police documents, which they tampered with their own documents in order to set up a frame. And just for the listening audience, if you put into Google civil rights on the chopping block, there's a tampered with dispatch call, there's a bogus subpoena, they're attached, documents attached to that article, which kind of gives some brief sort of discussion of what was going on. So at the time that I began to realize that I was really having a spotlight put on me, and given the fact that the police were tampering with their own documents in order to set up some sort of incriminating situation, I felt very unsafe, and I left. I packed up my house, I put it in storage, I left my beautiful orange cat with a devoted friend, and I left the country. And
but you,
I haven't regretted it.
Yeah, you but you went to Mexico and then you went to Canada, correct?
Yeah, I went to Mexico first. I was in Mexico for a week. There's, you know, kind of an underground railroad that's kind of getting established, and another talk show host, Michael Herzog, kind of directed me towards this woman down, we'll just say generically, on the Sea of Cortez. And I was down there for a week in her lovely home. She was a lovely and attentive and very concerned hostess. And after a week there, I was sort of surveying my options, you know, stay in Mexico, where they send bounty hunters to get you down in Mexico. The United States does that. And, you know, I would be in a country. I do speak Spanish. I am not completely fluent, but, you know, I do speak the language. But I didn't feel that that was probably the best place for me. So on September 10th, I crossed the border into Canada. I flew from Guadalajara to Mexico City up to Toronto. And I have been in Toronto since then. I'm getting some very strange communications from the Medford Police Department on the advice of the Oregon Department of Injustice. I was told that the correct lines to report, you know, this really massive misconduct by the police department towards me was to send a report into the city council, which I did a month and a half, 2 months ago. The city council never considered or reviewed the report. In fact, one of the police officers, which I was complaining about, Sergeant Brett Johnson of Internal Affairs, wrote me and said that he had done the investigation, that he had basically taken it over from the city council and he had investigated himself. Now, this raises some rather disturbing questions, because the police, you know, this is a complete violation of the Oregon state constitution. And I've been wondering sort of privately for a while, looking at all the police abuse that is going unchallenged now in the states. Police are tasering people. Police have attacked people and killed them. In Medford alone, people have been arrested and they find them dead in their cell the next day. There's no investigation. Nobody's doing anything about this. Nobody is hardly suing the police for or holding them accountable for anything anymore.
And that's not just in Medford.
There's a rare case. Yeah. Sorry?
And that's not just in Medford.
Oh, no, no, no. This is, no, I'm talking about all over the country. And I began, you know, very secretly.
It's very difficult to sue the police for false arrest or anything.
they've got carte blanche to do anything they want.
Well, they didn't used to. And there used to be, you know, some redress. But there isn't really any redress anymore. And what this made me wonder is, like, people are talking about martial law is coming. And I began to wonder if we really aren't already there. Because if you are instructed, if the state constitution says you send a report about police misconduct to the city council, and you do so, and the police come in, and one of the very officers you are complaining about does the investigation, then you don't have the appropriate lines for petitioning the government for redress. What you have is a police state. That's what a police state is. The police are in charge, and they are running it. And this is, you know, this has raised, besides, you know, my own alarm about my own situation, the fact that the city council, you know, job was superseded by the very police officer, one of the very police officers I was complaining about. I mean, this is really, really very disturbing. Now, I have sent off a report to the United States Department of Injustice. Excuse my Orwellian doublespeak. I didn't mean to say that. I have sent off a report to them concerning the situation, the longevity of the situation, what happened in the early 2000s that resulted in the attack on me by Officer Lauren Dawson of the Long Beach Police Department and his gang of officers. And I have sent this off to the DOJ. It is also up on the web. It is on Ray Fernandez's site. He has a website dealing with this conservatorship stuff and what's happening to the elderly and disabled. He has a blog, which is really wonderful, and it's called elderabusehelp.org. And it's filed under open letter from journalist Janet Phelan, which is, it has the cover letter I sent to the DOJ as well as 80 pages in PDF files of the entire report. So that is now in the hands of the U.S. DOJ, which is basically, you know, since my situation is now crossing state borders in terms of what happened in California following me up to Oregon, looks pretty much like, you know, this is a federal targeting situation. So we'll see what the U.S. DOJ does. I don't have a lot of faith in the fact the feds are going to come in and the feds are going to fix everything, because it's the feds that, you know, it's the federal agenda now, which is overriding states' rights, overriding individual rights. It really is the problem. But I felt that it was very important to get, you know, the shenanigans, and there's massive documentation, external documentation, the hospital records, court records, police records, of a continued inappropriate rights stripping and really very brutal and lethal sort of actions. So at least it's on file, and it's up on the web, and anyone can take a look at it. So we'll see what happens. My visa runs out in about 3 months, and at that point, I will be forced to leave Canada or become illegal here, which I'm not going to do. So hopefully at that point, it will be okay for me to come back home without, you know, having the specter of another police detainment, assault, you know, more nonsense.
For those who have...
This is it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Janet, I think that for those who are listening in the audience, I think it's important to remember Janet is an activist. Janet works for the rights of seniors, the rights of American civil liberties, heavily on civil liberties. And, you know, we talk about, you know, we kind of all joke between each other about, are we going into state of martial law? Are we actually going to see that in America? And they really have been testing, the bad guys in the authorities have been testing how to implement that. And what we're seeing is possibly the first steps of what that would look like. False arrest, false imprisonment, manipulation of the courts to deny people a trial, planting drugs. That's very serious, because then she would go to prison and she would have a criminal record. She'd have no recourse, because drugs are not something that you can deny. If they find them on you, it's hard to say that they weren't really there. So, you know, there's some pretty insidious things going on here, and it's all because of activism and opposition to the government. That's what Janet and I have in common. And so people should be concerned about this.
And the prior interviews that we had with Janet are also, for those who have access to the Internet, it's on www.givemesometruth.info under Janet Phelan. And there's several interviews there, and she's really dug into some issues that are huge, let alone the fact that now she's coming face to face with the prison complex that we have built up in America.
Yeah, and I also want to remind not to keep playing this note over and over again, but I'm a police assault survivor. I should have died from the assault on January 3rd of 2003. It's a miracle I didn't. So to me, the specter of an arrest, it doesn't mean, sitting in a jail cell, going to trial, talking to my attorney. What this means to me is they're going to do it again.
We certainly wish you success with that, and thank you for the heroic efforts that you continue to make. But instead of steering the show entirely in that way, I mean, since we're not here to suppress you in any way and really want to support your work, can you tell us a little bit more of what, say a massive effort had come out in support of your work, what are the real data that you would be giving us about water and about what we should be aware of and what we can do?
Right. The first article you need to put into Google is "Water as a Weapon." It's on Miami Indie. It's on a bunch of indie medias. I think you can check it out on Miami Indie Media because all of the documents are there. There's a second article, also by me, called "Water Wars: An Update." Basically, it has to do with the potential weaponizing of the water system. Well, it's not potential weaponizing. I mean, the weaponizing is going on. The weapons itself has not been unleashed. It has to do with the double line system. And you can read Water as a Weapon and see very clearly what that's about. Some people complained that some of the blueprints on that article attached to it were a little fuzzy. I certainly have much clearer ones now from other cities across America. So, I mean, I tell people, I don't know what kind of filter to use because I don't know what kind of toxin they're going to put in the second line. I simply advise people to start storing water. People are beginning to realize that they need to stock up on some stockpiles of food, and I especially am urging people to start storing water. The third article that I was working on at the time that the fit hit the Shan in Medford, I was tracing some of the, among other issues, tracing some of the international connections in terms of this weaponizing of the water system, and was tracing it back, surprise, to the Bayer Corporation, which was in Germany. And Bayer, as many people know, was kind of devolved after IG Farben, which had produced the fluoride for the death camps and also purportedly the Zyklon B used to gas people. IG Farben, after the war, was broken up into several smaller corporations, Bayer being the most significant. And there is a Bayer connection now going on with United States water systems, and it's a pretty scary thing. I'm trying, I sort of got interrupted in finishing that article, and it will not be appearing in the American's Bulletin at this point in time, but it will be up on the web shortly.
Well,
we're in very dark times, and it takes a lot of
intestinal fortitude, you know, for people like Susan to walk through the nightmare she has walked through. And you know, listen to her. She is so intelligent. She is so eloquent.
Thank you.
Oh, no, I have to commend both of you guys for all the work and efforts that you've been
throw something about Janet's water story that is a true and not so funny, though we could all laugh when you hear this. I can tell you that I know somebody who, I cannot name him, but I know somebody who was involved in water as a weapon. And he helped to develop a biological weapon, and they ran a limited test on a small part of the Potomac River in between Virginia and Washington, and it caused the fish to swim backwards.
Whoa.
And I'm not kidding. That's what sounds funny. It caused the fish to swim backwards. But they got caught because fishermen were out on the water and they were fishing, and they found these fish that had hideous open wounds on their bodies. And so it was intended to, I heard from my friend that the biological weapon, which they tried in the Virginia water system, was intended to make cattle woozy and to make them kind of fall over and lose track of where they were so that they wouldn't be able to be oriented towards their surroundings. But of course, it's not only cattle who are going to drink the water, it's the people. And so the water system would be used to cause the people to be disoriented and not functional and not be able to resist any kind of invasion.
You know, we could go on and on this, and I'd like to, you know, have you back again and approach some of these subjects, because you've got all kinds of information that I would find kind of, you know, important for the public to be aware of. And Janet and Susan, I want to thank you both for coming on the program and again for all that you've done and trying to do the right thing. And let's just hope that next week you have somebody on your side and that you, you know, you're out here to continue to put the truth out there. Anything else, Shannon?
Oh, good luck and thank you. That's all.
Okay. And you guys, that anything else before we go?
Thanks a lot.
Okay. And thank you again, Janet. And
keep the faith.
Okay.
Take care.
All right. And thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.